The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the simplest, most powerful website creator that helps you make headlines with your own stunning online presence. Explore elegant templates, Getty image integration, and more at squarespace.com and use the code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Hannah Devlin. Coming up on the show this week, how often do you have sex? Where, when, and are you normal? David Spiegelhalter has the answers. Professor of the Public Understanding of Risk at Cambridge University, David was knighted for his services to science last year and might seem an unlikely candidate to be studying our sex lives in intimate detail. But his new book, Sex by Numbers, is an eyebrow-raising look at sexual behaviour. He covers everything from myths that are trotted out down the pub to a scientific study of sexual behaviour in Britain that has run for 30 years. Also on the show, we have Professor Anne Johnson, who pioneered that very piece of research. And joining me in the studio is Ian Sample, the Guardian science editor, to talk to David and Anne about one-night stands, the seven-year itch, and everything in between. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Professor David Spiegelhalter set himself an ambitious task with his new book, to sift through the vast amount of information that's out there on sex and work out what's really true. He uses his statistical expertise to shed some light on what we're all up to in the bedroom, how often, and in some cases, whether we're being truthful about it. Joining us in the studio now is David and The Guardian's Ian Sample. David, most people think of statistics as being quite a dry, serious subject. So what's a self-respecting numbers man like yourself doing writing a book about sex?
I find sex quite interesting, but I find statistics even more interesting. So the combination of the two, for me, is a winner. And it's because sex is so challenging for statisticians. Statisticians are used to analysing road accidents and measles and things like that. Well, you can count those pretty easily. Trying to count what goes on in people's bedrooms, most of them, you know, mostly in people's bedrooms, I presume, is much more difficult. We know there's a lot of stuff happens, but what happens is very difficult to work out. So you have to, you know, do it slightly obliquely. You either have to just ask people to report what they're doing, which is notoriously difficult and rather unreliable, or you have to do it slightly indirectly by measuring things you can measure, like babies being born, people having abortions, teenagers getting pregnant, and so on.
So I think your book raises this right at the start, the challenges of trying to study this area. And you've even created a five-point rating system for whether things are essentially nonsense that we can cast to one side or whether they're watertight facts. Could you just tell me a bit about where that idea came from and how we could use that ourselves when we're trying to work out whether we should believe something?
Well, sex is an area with notoriously bad statistics. You go onto not any internet site, but if you just Google sex statistics, you'll get lists of these numbers, most of which are unreliable drivel. And how can we sort out what are the good ones from what are the bad ones? It's something I do all the time in my job as a statistician, trying to take numbers apart. And in this area, of course, some are really reliable. You know, we do know how many babies are born. We know, for example, you know, that one in six women, when they got married in 1938, were pregnant at the time. That's a very reliable statistic. Half of women under 20 who got married were pregnant at the time in 1938. These are reliable statistics based on official numbers matching birth with marriage dates. But other statistics, then, are totally just made up, the complete drivel. The men, you know, thinking of sex every 7 seconds. The old Victorian figure, the Bishop of Exeter, said there are 80,000 prostitutes in London. And he's just making this stuff up. So this is what I call zero star. Four star are the really good numbers we can believe. And in between, you've got these other grades. And I just found it very useful to be able to classify all the not just the current sex surveys, but historical sex surveys, Sheer Height, Kinsey, etc., into this grading system.
David, what sort of things are these statistics useful for?
Well, I suppose answering our prurient curiosity, I suppose, that, you know, people would like to know where they are in the distribution of behaviours. People, I think, are genuinely interested in what other people get up to. So I think it's a matter of reasonable information that we should know about these things.
Well, give me some examples.
Oh, I don't know. You know, the number of sexual, one of the graphs I've got in there, the number of sexual partners reported by people between age between 35 and 44, which I am not, I should add. And there you just see this huge distribution of behaviour, with the highest response being one. The most common response is, I've had one sexual partner. But then with this long right-hand tail that goes off, I actually cut the graph at 50, because if I went up to 500, which is what was reported, you know, it would take up, the page would have to be so elongated. So, and in between, you can just see how people respond to a question like that. That for 1 to 9 or 1 to 12, you get the, you know, individual numbers. When you get beyond 10, 11, 12, people start, you know, getting a bit vague. They can't remember, and they start going 15, 20, 30, 50, well, who knows? And they're making vague stabs at it. And so just from that graph, you get extraordinary insights into how people respond to a question like that.
Speaking of that question, one of the interesting things that your book had was that men claim to have an average of 14 sexual partners, and women say that they have 7 on average. Is that statistically plausible? Could that work out?
It's mathematically impossible. If we talk about opposite sex partners, and we're actually talking about average in terms of the mean, that's the total number of partnerships divided by the total number of people. If you have a population with equal number of men and women, the averages should match. They don't, and they never do. It's pretty well every survey that's been done, men will say roughly, you know, they've had twice as many partners on average. Now, the point about averages, as we should know, is that they're hugely influenced by extreme observations. You know, if Bill Gates walks into the room, the average income, or walks into a small country, the average income shoots up, whereas the median income, of course, doesn't change at all. And similarly for sexual partners, as I mentioned, some people reporting, you know, 100, 500, that can have a massive, you know, a few of those can have quite a big influence. It isn't enough, really, to explain this difference, which is highly consistent. And all sorts of other explanations have been suggested. It can be explained to some extent by the age of the people being asked the questions. They're missing out some older men who have had fewer sexual partners. But in the end, there is a feeling that men are reporting more sexual partners than women. Now, why is that the case? Now, are they deliberately lying? Is there this sort of social desirability bias, as it's known, that people are embarrassed to admit, women are more embarrassed to admit numbers of partners, and men are all gung-ho and boastful about it? Well, actually, the people who do these surveys don't think it's such a deliberate thing. A lot of it may be, in a sense, people are making vague stabs, as I said. Once it gets into double figures, if not triple figures, people are making very vague stabs. And maybe men are just making vague stabs upwards rather than downwards.
I was going to ask if you get any sense of what people are most interested in, whether there are any surveys that look at the kinds of information about sex people want to know. You've said how people are keen to know, where do I fit on the spectrum of the number of partners, you know, compared to other people. What about other details of all of this?
Well, the point is that it depends what kind of survey you're talking about. These national surveys are expensive. It costs £7 million, the last one, you know, funded by national organisations. They are not actually going to ask, what sexual position do you enjoy? That is just not part of it. However, they do ask now much broader questions about willingness to have sex, whether you had it against your will, about whether you intended to get pregnant or not, about whether you're competent at first sex and all things like that. So there's a lot. It's not more than just asking about frequency, change of partners, unprotected sex, and so on. If you want the more, you know, juicy stuff, you know, the real gossipy stuff, then there are surveys that, of course, that provide that kind of information. But there will be the sort of surveys, the sort of volunteer online fill in our sex survey, which actually you can't believe a word of it. As people have said, it only represents the people who choose to fill in that survey. So it does represent, you know, the behaviour, presuming they're telling the truth, of that particular group of people. But it doesn't enable you really to say anything about the rest of the population. One star, That's
what try and tell those surveys change, though. The kind of official ones, the ones that are pretty reliable. You say that, you know, new questions do come onto those surveys. Why? What are people...
They've changed. Yeah. For example, sometimes new questions come on because they weren't considered appropriate to ask. Masturbation wasn't asked in 1990 because in the sort of customer testing, that was people didn't want to talk about that. It's in there 2000, 2010. Everyone's upfront about it. That's fine. Let's talk about it. But it's also to do with the changing way in which sexual health is defined. It used to be very much to do with disease. Remember, these surveys grew out of the HIV, you know, sort of panic in the late 1980s. It used to be in terms of disease, about teenage pregnancy, and so on. Sexual health, led by the WHO, has really changed as an issue. It's much more now to do with well-being, and in particular, establishing for young people consent for, you know, the stages of sexual development. So it's not necessarily, oh, you shouldn't have sex, or you should wear a condom. Okay, yeah, fair enough, you should wear a condom. But it's changed, and so the surveys have reflected that change towards sexual health being an aspect of well-being. For a start, they now ask about sexual problems. They ask about whether people are distressed or worried about their sex lives. They ask again about competence at first sex. And this fits in very strongly with the change in sex education that people like great organizations like the PSHE Association are pushing through with their guidance on gaining consent, teaching kids in schools about consent in sex and how vital that is. Because we've got to assume they're going to be taught about condoms and disease and pregnancy. And teenage pregnancy rates are going down consistently. Young people are getting more competent when they first have sex. But so now the issues are about consent, not just about sex, but about, you know, taking photographs of yourself and sending them around and things like that.
I have to ask about the masturbation data since you bring it up. When you come to having graphs with the 14-year-olds and 15-year-olds on there, do you need to use a log scale?
That's how it only goes down to 16.
What are the figures on masturbation, though, for the rates?
Well, if we do look at the youngest age group in NATSAR, 16 to 24-year-olds, and we look at men without a current steady partner, maybe the sort of people you're thinking about, it's about 90% say they've masturbated over the last 4 weeks. And that drops with age, but not that much. And so overall, over the group of people asked, 60% of men will say they've masturbated in the last 4 weeks, and 40% of women will say they have. I have to say I quite enjoyed writing about masturbation because it's got a fascinating history. You could say it was invented in 1712, which is, of course, not true because Samuel Pepys reports his activities in his diary. But before the start of the 18th century, it wasn't considered a very serious matter at all. But then the great masturbation panic started in around 1712 with the publication of Onania, the book that identified self-pollution as this heinous sin that was going to, you know, do terrible things to young people, men and women, you know, the clammy hands, the blindness. And that went on all through the 18th century. Across the 19th century and into the 20th century. So, you know, the masturbation panic, you know, really is a good 250 years of the real harm of masturbation was being pushed by these great eminent authorities. And this wasn't a religious, you know, objection. It was a scientific objection because there was all this evidence about how masturbation did these terrible things to you.
What sort of things did they worry about?
Well, they claimed that, first of all, they identified that many people in lunatic asylums masturbated. So it must have been the masturbation that put them in the lunatic asylum, which is actually what we would call reverse causation. I think they might have got the arrow a bit wrong there. But it's association and is not causation. I mean, we know that from so many scientific studies, but that's what the Victorians thought.
I wanted to ask about some of these figures that you often hear thrown around that we all probably have in the back of our mind, but I've got no idea where they come from. So the men thinking about sex every 7 seconds. Did you get to the bottom of where that figure came from?
I searched and searched. I mean, maybe someone can find the originator for that claim, but it is such nonsense. But of course, then you say, well, how do you disprove it? How often do men think about sex? Well, these are very difficult experiments to do. They give students little clickers to wander around and say, well, click when you're thinking about sex or food or whatever. Well, that's likely to influence, though, you know, what they're thinking about. Of course, they do find out that people think about food more than sex. Another one, which I thought was slightly better, is that they give people, or smartphones or something, and then send out signals at random moments during the day and say, what are you thinking about? What are you thinking about now? And again, people say they're thinking about food more than sex, and it's not that often. You know.
And it's not every 7 seconds.
It's not every 7 seconds, but there is huge variability. I mean, I something I deal with quite a lot in the book is, you know, where do numbers come from? If you go onto NHS Choices website, for example, they'll tell you that if a man has sex with a woman who's got gonorrhea, there's about a 20% chance he'll catch it from a single occasion. Where does that number come from? You know, how do you know? And you really have to search. You go back and back and back. And you find out it originates from a single visit of a US aircraft carrier to a naval base in the Philippines in the Vietnam War. When, after 4 days rest and recreation on shore, when the sailors came back on board, 54 of them had caught gonorrhea. And so they interview all the crew, what they got up to, how many hostesses they slept with or whatever. Then there was also a survey done of hostesses in the port, you know, of how many actually had gonorrhea. And then using a rather neat mathematical model, they estimated that there was a 1 in 5 chance of each of these sailors catching gonorrhea from a single act of sex. And that number now is just, that is the universal number used throughout the world on all the NHS websites and things like that. And it came from this US aircraft carrier in the Vietnam War.
What about the one, what about the figure that 10% of people are gay? That's often mentioned. And
yeah.
I think you did find the source
that grew out of Kinsey from the 1940s and then was used in the gay liberation movement very strongly in the 1970s. And, you know, part of the headline, you know, we're everywhere, 10% are gay. Now, fortunately, because the discussion about this has grown in sophistication a lot, because actually, what does it mean to say you are gay? And now there's a clear distinction made in surveys between self-professed sexual identity. What would you label yourself as? And those are part now of official national statistics in this country. It's asked by the Office of National Statistics. You know, is self-professed sexual identity. Then, of course, you've got same-sex attraction, and then you've got same-sex behavior. And what statistics show is the proportion that have engaged in same-sex behavior is massively greater than the proportion who say they self-label themselves as gay or even bisexual. So you've got to say, what do you mean by 10% of the population gay? If you mean, you know, who professes themselves as gay, no, it's not that. It's about 1% or 2% would say gay, another 1% or 2% would say they're bisexual. That still adds up to a million in the UK, you know, more than a million, 1.2 million or so. But if you look at actually people who have had same-sex behavior, particularly now young women, where we're talking about, you know, 1 in 6 having had same-sex experience and 1 in 20 actually had a sexual partner with genital contact over the last 5 years, then, you know, the figures are a lot higher than that. And actually, it's very rough, but, and it depends what age group you're talking about, and things are very fluid at the moment. Who knows what's going to happen? But I think, you know, 10% of people, if you include fairly transient sexual behaviour, 10% isn't a bad figure at all.
So the other one I wanted to ask about, which makes me slightly nervous, I have to say, is the 7-year itch. I've been with my husband for 7 years.
Time to watch out. I mean, this is a classic statistic, of course, and one I thought, oh, this is a whole lot of nonsense. It's true. Well, it's true to an extent. It's even a 4-star statistic. The Office of National Statistics then, you know, measure marriages and they measure divorces and they subtract the two and look at, for each year that a marriage has lasted, what proportion fail in that year. So given that your marriage has survived a certain length of time, what proportion fail the subsequent year? And if you plot that as a graph, it starts off low. You know, not many people will get divorced in their first year unless you're some, you know, celebrity maybe. And then it goes up and up and up, and it reaches a peak at 7 years, and then it drops down and down and down and down. Your marriage essentially gets safer as you get older, as it goes on. So 7 years is the peak time, the peak risk time for a marriage. Now, that is a 4-star statistic. You know, it's just true. No arguing. It is true. Now, but is that the correct statistic? Because now, you know, people will generally have lived together for about 3 years before they get married, on average. The average age at which people first give birth is now less than the average age at which people got married. You know, having a baby and getting married now is almost, you know, disconnected. So we're not talking about 7 years since the beginning of the relationship. But we are also talking about divorce rather than, you know, getting, you know, fed up with each other, maybe. So
I've not actually been married 7 years.
Oh, I see.
So I've got a few more years.
Well, yeah. Well, exactly. This is since the beginning of marriage. Right. This is 7 years is the highest risk time since the beginning of marriage.
What are the trends that you come across which are most sort of surprising to you?
I think the standard one everyone focuses on is people having less sex. You know, opposite sex couples reducing the frequency with which they had sex over the last 20 years. That's a strong finding.
How much by?
Well, it used to be for 16 to 44-year-old people within that age range, 16 to 44, it'd be 5 times every 4 weeks, and the median was 20 years ago, went down to 4 times. In 2000, in 2010, it was 3 times. So by 2040, nobody will be having any sex at all. So, but we statisticians don't do such naive extrapolations. But it has gone down.
So as well as serving to satisfy our prurient curiosity about what everyone's up to in the bedroom, statistics about sex can have political implications, can't they, as well? And one of the ones you mention in your book is that last year, prostitution was included in GDP measurements for the first time. And you had some criticisms about the way that had been calculated.
Prostitution statistics have always been deeply contested. I talk about in the book about in Victorian London, these huge differences in claims between the amount of prostitution going on. And that hasn't stopped. There's a huge discussion about, what proportion of people, sex workers, are trafficked or doing it against their will. Deeply contested figures. But it's become of serious political importance now because, as you said, it's now prostitution earnings have to be part of GDP, part of our national accounts. And the Office of National Statistics made a guess at it last year at £5.3 billion. And in the book, I actually take that apart and just say I just don't believe the assumptions that was based on because it's based on... on there being about based on 60,000 sex workers working and they're charging around about £80 a time on average, but that they're working 5 days a week full time. They're seeing 25 clients a week, and this just doesn't seem to fit the model. It would mean, for example, that the sex workers, since there's 61,000 of them, are turning over £100,000 a year on average, which is completely preposterous. It's just not the case.
And where did that figure about the number of prostitutes?
Oh, the number of prostitutes, that's probably not too bad. And that was based on scaling up a survey that had been done in London from some time ago. And this would all have to change now because the nature of prostitution has changed so much. If you go on to the most popular sex work advertising site, which I won't mention, but anyone can find it, there's 30,000 individuals there advertising, including 11,000 men. Who weren't included in the ONS figures at all. So, it's changed much more into, self-employed people working from home, working very part-time, very, very, not working as a seeing 25 clients a week. That model was based on Amsterdam, sort of prostitutes in the streets, which are, or in the brothels there, which are, high, very different sort of trade. And so those numbers are being revised now. I'm going to be very interested in seeing what happens to them. People who work, who know about this area, say that they're very much an overestimate of what's going on.
So what do you think people can take away from the book?
Well, I hope they find some of the numbers interesting and some of the stories interesting. I think they're fascinating. The struggles that, past researchers have gone through in order to get some of this data. I think it's fascinating. But what I do hope that people take away from it is both the power and the limitations of statistics. Statistics can tell you these wonderful things if they're well collected, but they can be complete nonsense if they're badly done. And there's nothing in a number itself, apart from maybe its plausibility to you, that will tell you that. You have to know how it was arrived at. What did people do to collect it? We know that Kinsey went into prisons and gay bars to collect his data and things like that. Is this going to be representative? Oh, it's interesting, but is it going to be representative? So that's what I hope people take away from it, that statistics can do a lot. They can't tell you why, and you can, with a little bit of digging and detective work, start deciding how much you can believe things and actually how reliable they are.
There is a serious side to all this, of course. Joining us now is Anne Johnson, Professor of Infectious Disease Epidemiology at University College London. Back in the 1980s, Anne was working at the Middlesex Hospital, which was treating some of the UK's first AIDS cases. The fear of an HIV epidemic really brought home to researchers how little we know about sexual behaviour and the fact that they really weren't able to predict how things were going to unfold. This realisation prompted Anne to come up with the idea for a major national survey on sexual behaviour. And in 1991, the first British National Survey of Sexual Attitudes and Lifestyles was published, which interviewed nearly 19,000 men and women. Anne, what was the reaction when you first proposed the survey, and why do you think some people, such as Thatcher, were opposed?
Well, on the one hand, I think we had a lot of support from some elements of the academic community who could see why we needed a survey. There were, however, some people who thought it just wasn't possible to go and ask a proper random representative sample of the population about their sexual lifestyles. So some of the objection was, is this possible? And the objection from Thatcher seems to have been more about this not being a kind of appropriate area or too private an area for scientific inquiry. That seems curious now in retrospect, but at the time there was a real focus on concerns around the gay population, and people were perfectly happy for studies to be done in the gay population, but curiously not in the general population.
Why did it need to cover the whole population? Because, like you said, a lot of the concern around the epidemic at the time was focused on the gay population.
Well, that's true at the beginning of the epidemic, but of course we rapidly realised, and that was actually my first piece of research, was to show that HIV could be transmitted heterosexually. So we first of all had to know what, as regards the gay epidemic, what proportion of the population had same-sex partners. So that was a big question. And the second was, amongst the heterosexual population, how much partner change was there? How often did people have new partners, because that was going to be a major driver of any transmission into the heterosexual population. But where you're looking for something that's quite a relatively rare behaviour, you need to actually study a large sample size in order to accurately measure that small proportion.
And those two criticisms you came up with about privacy and about getting a representative sample, so doing a really scientific study, they're valid in that they are genuine challenges for trying to study this area. Could you just tell us a bit about how you overcame those, or to what extent you did?
Yes, well, interestingly, the Thatcher ban actually came when we'd already completed a whole lot of preparatory feasibility work. So the first objection was that we wouldn't be able to get people to participate was really overturned. We'd already done the work, which showed that when we went to a random sample of the population, and this was by selecting randomly households and inviting one member from each of the selected households to participate, we could achieve response rates of around 65%, which was the same as for any kind of study. That was the first thing. And secondly, we did a huge amount of work on how we asked the questions. We asked people what sort of language we should use, and they wanted quite formal language. We explained to them the seriousness of the reason for the study, which at the time there was a great deal of fear about the spread of HIV. And then we made sure that every question that was included in the survey we could justify to ourselves scientifically as a question that really had to be answered if we were to understand how HIV might spread in the population. We were really careful on wording, really careful on privacy, and I think people understood the serious public health intent. You have to remember, at the time, everybody was getting leaflets through their letterbox. There was a huge amount of advertising about AIDS, HIV. So the public were perfectly able to accept it. I think actually the medical profession, perhaps less so, talking about sex is something they still find difficult, I think.
So it sounds like there hadn't really been much detailed exploration of sex in a scientific way until then. What were some of the most surprising findings for people when you published the first results?
The only large-scale surveys that had been done before NatSal was, of course, the very famous studies by Kinsey in the 1940s, but they were, first of all, in America, and they weren't in random sample surveys. So these, really, HIV surveys were the first. So I don't think we knew what to expect. So everything was a surprise, if you like.
Were there any figures or discoveries that seemed to go against what you might have expected from the way people talk about their sex lives?
Well, the things for me that were really striking was how we could actually see how much people's sex lives had changed in the 30 or 40 years before the survey, because we were interviewing people from the age of 16 to 59. So really fascinatingly, we could see that from the, and this wasn't the purpose of the study, if you like, but from the 1950s onwards, the age at first intercourse had been rapidly declining. It's really interesting. People born in the 1930s would typically have had their first intercourse around 20, 21. Whereas for people who were born in the 1980s, then the age at first intercourse had dropped by about three or four years. So there's this huge social change, I think, driven by a whole number of factors, but first of all, driven by a whole social change about the different roles of men and women in society, more women going into the workplace, so patterns of sexual behaviour were changing, sex before marriage had become from uncommon to common to now ubiquitous, and the number of partners that people were having had gradually increased quite dramatically. For me, one of the most interesting things is that a lot of those social changes were driving the change in behaviour before the legislative changes came in. So one has to think back a long way to remember that, you know, in the end of the 1960s, we had no really reliable contraception. Sex between men was criminalised. It was only decriminalised in the late 1960s. Mm. There was no Abortion Law Reform Act. But the kind of changes of increasing numbers of partners, declining age at first sex, were all happening before any of those technological or legislative solutions came in. So they were somehow a response, perhaps, to social change rather than the other way around.
That's really interesting. Mm. And so you've done two more big surveys since then at 10-year intervals. Have you seen those trends continuing? And are there other things that have dramatically changed since?
I think the thing that really surprised us in 2000 was that we saw a big increase in what would be termed risk behaviour in terms of HIV between 1990 and 2000. So many more men said that they'd had same-sex partners, and we saw an increase in numbers of partners. And when I first saw those results, I was surprised. And then when I thought about it afterwards, I thought, well, actually, that is in a way what you'd expect. Because what had happened was, following the AIDS public education campaigns, there'd been a very big change in behaviour. Or we assume there was a big change in behaviour, because things like gonorrhea, sexually transmitted infections, virtually disappeared. It was an absolute extraordinary decline in gonorrhea rates in the 1980s, and that was all due to behaviour change, because there was no change in treatment or anything like that. And then, of course, when we'd done the first survey, that was at the time when people were at their least risky. You know, everyone had changed to sort of safer behaviours, and then gradually there had been a sort of reversion back to more risky behaviours between 1990 and 2000.
And what about what you can learn about people's attitudes? There's sometimes this feeling that everyone's having more and more sex, that we're in a promiscuous society. Is that reflected in the changes you've seen over the past 30 years?
It's really interesting, actually, how the attitudes have changed. It's fascinating. So we've seen, since the 1990s, I mean, much, much more acceptance of gay relationships, but interestingly, less acceptance of sex outside of, if someone's in a committed relationship, people don't approve of them having another partner. In other words, it's sort of disapproval of, never use these words, but it's a kind of disapproval of what would be termed cheating. I think that's really fascinating, because people seem to be, on the one hand, much, much more accepting of diversity. So people are much more, you know, happy about different kind of family structures, different parenting structures, different gender relationships, as long as everybody is consenting to those activities.
There's a lot of concern about how teenagers are being exposed to lots more sex and pornography on the internet, which gives almost unlimited access to explicit images and so on. Is there any evidence that that's changed attitudes among young people about what they're expecting from sex?
Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of data on people's use of pornography, but we do have some questions, which the results of which we published just a few weeks ago, in relationship to the extent that people use porn to learn about sex. And actually, we find that it's a really quite a surprisingly small fraction, given the publicity about it, of the population. And the number of boys that say that porn was their main source of sex education is actually very small. What's also fascinating is that the proportions who say they got most of their sex education from school has risen quite markedly. We'd like to think that some of our information on that was actually important in sex education policy. So people are more likely to be learning about sex from schools, and they want to learn about sex from authoritative sources. So that when we ask, who would you want to learn about sex from, they say school predominantly, but also parents are important. And so, you know, we think there's more work to be done both within schools and amongst parents to educate young people. They're not wanting those informal sources to the same extent.
So I imagine that when the media has reported your work, we've often focused on how often people are doing it and what's normal and so on. But there have been also practical public health implications from the findings. It'd be good to just hear a bit about that side and about what you think the main things are that have changed thanks to your data.
So I think the fact that the data themselves are widely publicised in the media is really important in its own right, because people then can see what is the range of activities and that they kind of fit in. I think it's easy for magazine surveys, which are very biased because the people who respond to those are not a representative sample of the population, can give the view that everybody's having sex all the time. And when we actually come to the reality, it isn't like that at all. So I felt that some of the articles in the last survey were a sort of collective sigh of relief that it was all okay if our sex lives weren't 100% perfect all the time. And that's very reassuring to people, actually, that they can see that they do fit in, that there's a huge variety of how people behave. In a way, there isn't any such thing as normal. There are averages, but, you know, there's a huge spread around those averages. So we like that in its own right, and that helps people to see how they fit in. But when it comes to sexual health policy, I think there are lots of things that we hope we've influenced. One, which was the lowering of the age of homosexual consent, because we knew the age at which people first had homosexual partners. A second was using the data to think about the introduction of the HPV vaccination programme and the appropriate timing of that, because we had data on age at first sex.
So this is the vaccine that's now given to all girls?
Yes, to prevent cervical cancer. Yeah. A third one would be that we've also included in the last two surveys measures of the prevalence of chlamydia infection in the population. And that has had some influence on the chlamydia screening programme, which originally was only for young women, but then we showed that there was as much asymptomatic infection in young men, so men were included in that. And then I think there are other kind of things that we've been able to look at about people's preference and use of contraception services and also sex education. Because one of the fears around sex education would be that somehow teaching people about sex would make them have sex earlier. But all the data, there are no data really that suggests that sex education reduces the age at first sex. On the contrary, if anything, it seems to make it later. Our observational data would suggest those who have good sex education in school have a later age at first sex. So all that is, I think, very useful evidence for policy.
So looking to the future, is there going to be another NatSal survey in 10 years' time, or 5 years' time now?
Shockingly, it is only 5 years away, and we'll have to start thinking about the next one. I think it's fair to say the largest and most detailed surveys probably in the world. I can't think of another country that has had quite so many detailed surveys so regularly. So, of course, yes, I'd like to see another one done. I'm also keen that we see questions about sexual behaviour being seen as part of the norm of what of things that you might measure when you're looking at health. So I would also like to see, and we've done some of this, questions on sex, including in things like the Health Survey for England. There are a few questions, for example, on some of the big cohort studies. At last, it seems like things are beginning. Sex is at last being seen as part of people's lives and normalised. I like to think that's part of the survey's role as well.
And is there anything that has been omitted so far that you'd really like to see included in the next survey?
Well, we have a little notebook where we note down all the questions we forgot to ask, or the questions that we didn't think of asking because times change. Clearly, one of the things is how differently people communicate. I mean, social media, the way people meet partners, Tinder, all these new apps and things which just didn't exist in our pre-internet surveys in the 1990s, are totally changing the way we interact socially and how we find partners. So I think that's a really important area. Another one which we were reluctant to address and nervous about addressing is sexual violence. And with all the discussion that's going on, I think that's a really important area that's been swept under the carpet for too long. And the data that we produced this time were, I think, very important again in trying to understand what has been going on and how we can really put in better services. The third one, which we did do this time, was obviously on older people. And I think that was great too, because it again, changes our perception of sex. We think about sex as risky and dangerous for young people. You know, it's always seen unplanned pregnancy, STIs and so on. So again, I think next time around, one would like to see more about not just sexual ill health, but really sexual health. How is sex good for us? How does it enhance or improve our lives, and where doesn't it? And some of those much more sex-positive messages than we might have had 20 years ago.
Guardian listeners get the latest news, but they can also create it. With our sponsor Squarespace, you can easily create an elegant website for your personal brand, online store, business, personal portfolio, or blog. Whoever you are, Squarespace's simple tools and elegant designs make your ideas newsworthy and accessible to any audience. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
This is the biggest story in the world.
We will look back on these times and we will think, what on earth were we doing?
From The Guardian.
This is a story about people, and this is a story about possibility.
It's a story that's eluded us for decades.
It's clearly the most important story that we could be thinking about, and yet you scan the daily newspapers and it's almost absent.
A topic which The Guardian is now throwing itself wholeheartedly into.
I'd seen how we'd done it on other things.
Climate change.
Bill's simple proposition and his urgently was, this stuff has to be kept in the ground. It cannot be dug up.
So we're letting you in behind the scenes. Editorial meetings, bids for commissions. You'll hear what works, as well as our mistakes. And along the way, you can judge how we do. Is there a new way to make the world care?
That's the challenge. What can you do that will force them to sit up and pay attention?
The biggest story in the world on The Guardian.
Let's turn to the week in science, Ian. What's caught your eye this week?
Well, as you know, scientists have spent centuries wrestling with the deep problems of time, space, nature of consciousness, but not all scientists. Some scientists, including a team at University of Alberta, went for slightly more sort of low-hanging fruit, if you like, and they tried to understand the mystery of knuckle cracking. And they came out with a paper which was the first to show in an MRI scanner what happens inside a knuckle when you crack it. Now, this is something that I thought kind of died at the end of the 1970s. I didn't realize people still crack their knuckles. I thought it was something uncles did, and maybe it still is. But it turns out, if you look at the medical literature, that there is a bit of a mystery, a bit of a puzzle about what actually causes the noise. And you can go to papers back as far as 1938, where people are first saying, what is that noise? Where is it coming from? And then in 1947, a British team from St. Thomas's come in and say, oh, we think we've got an idea. And then a team from Leeds come in 1971, and we think you're wrong, we've got a better idea. So this team from Alberta found an expert knuckle-cracker. He actually came to them with a theory, a new theory of how knuckle-cracking might work. And they said, never mind your new theory. What we'll do is we'll just stick you in an MRI scanner and check. Just look at what happens.
And so how did they go about doing that experiment?
So what you do is you get your MRI scanner, you get your expert knuckle-cracker in the MRI scanner, and his finger goes in what I can only describe as a sort of Mexican finger trap, which is a kind of a tube that goes on your finger, and it pulls your finger as if it's trying to pull it off your hand. And it pulls it at different sort of tensions. And once you get to a particular sort of stress, if you like, your finger will kind of suddenly give. It's hard, pull, and then it'll suddenly go, and it'll kind of come away about 5 millimeters. And that's when you get the pop. Now, what happens? What causes the pop? Is it some sort of physical clicking of bones or something? No, what these guys reckon, they're not absolutely sure, but what they think what they're seeing is what they call a vapor cavity. So basically, it's like if you imagine you're doing the washing up and you've got a couple of plates. Glass plates work pretty well, actually, where the water kind of forms a film between them and they're really quite hard to pull apart. That's like the synovial fluid in your joint. And when you pull them apart, it's hard at first, and then it suddenly goes. You create a drop in pressure inside that synovial fluid, and it seems as if some sign of gas comes out of the solution, forms a little pocket of air. You get your pop, and then your finger can go back into its normal position, and it'll take you about 20 minutes before you can do it again.
So the popping noise is basically that bubble of gas popping.
These guys are pretty sure that it's the creation of the bubble of gas that is producing the popping sound. They're not absolutely sure. It may still be that there's something they're not seeing that is doing it, but their money is on the creation of this little air pocket, this little gas pocket, when you pull your finger. And for that amazing scientific discovery, you can see a video on our website, theguardian.com/science.
And that's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to Professor David Spiegelhalter, Professor Anne Johnson, and Ian Sample. From me, Hannah Devlin, and all at the science team, thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.